Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Monica Attard. On Monday this week, a new report from Media Diversity Australia sent shockwaves around the country and, of course, its newsrooms. Or maybe I should say, should have sent shockwaves. The report is called Who Gets to Tell Australian Stories? And it paints a damning picture of our newsrooms, not just being overwhelmingly white, but in many cases, completely lacking any form of diversity outside the odd European-sounding name. We'll get to the details soon, but consider this. When our newsrooms are overwhelmingly Anglo-Saxon and European in makeup, how can they speak for all and to all Australians? If the pandemic has taught us any lasting lesson, it is that we really are all in this together, but it seems together doesn't extend to who gets to tell the stories on our TV screens. Before we begin, a declaration from me. I'm a founding member of the Media Diversity Australia Advisory Board, and I am committed to its mission. So to help us grapple with this most important of issues, I'm happy to say that we have two Australian journalists with us who will bring their experience, their knowledge and their diverse backgrounds to this matter. Sushi Does is the Chief of Staff, RMIT ABC Fact Check. She's also a former opinion editor for The Age. She's the winner of two Melbourne Press Club Quill Awards, including Best Columnist in 2005. And she's also the author of Deranged Marriage, a memoir. Bakri Mahmood is a social media producer for the ABC. He's been a media cadet for ABC Life and reporter at ABC Far North Queensland. So, the report, Who Gets to Tell Australian Stories? It took a two-week slice from all five of our TV networks and major regional players in June of last year, that is 2019. The results are damning, or should be damning, for anyone working in or managing in the media industry. In short, when you look at the industry-wide figures of 270 presenters, commentators and reporters during the time sampled, almost 89% were Anglo-Saxon or European in background. And when you start to break this figure down, the picture just gets worse. Channel 9, for instance, was 97% Anglo-Saxon or European, with 2.9% coming from non-European backgrounds and 0% identifying as Indigenous. To put this number of less than 3% in perspective, the 2016 census found that 21% of Australians are non-European and 3% identify as Indigenous. And the major regional stations were also just terrible in their lack of diversity. So, Sushi, let me start with you. The report was pretty damning of the media industry, showing it to be hopelessly unrepresentative of the wider community. Were you at all surprised by the findings?
No, I'm afraid I wasn't. We have seen this picture before of a lack of representation of diverse voices in the media. There have been other reports in the past, certainly previously by the then Race Discrimination Commissioner Tim Pomasan had a report where he looked where they found that it wasn't just a lack of diversity in media. There's a lack of diversity in politics, in business, in the public service, and in the our higher echelons of our universities as well. So I'm afraid this report didn't come as a surprise to me.
No, and Bakri, what was your response when you heard the news?
I had been kind of following Media Diversity's reports for a while, so it didn't really come as a surprise to me. It was kind of this thing where suddenly there was a lot of attention on it, and so I was like, oh, okay, they must have finally released the report. But it came to absolutely no surprise. I think the numbers are visibly clear in any editorial meeting or newsroom that I've ever been in.
So, Bakri, you've been working in the media for a couple of years now. First of all, can you just give us a little bit of your background and also talk to us a little bit about how easy or otherwise it's been for you in the media?
Yeah, absolutely. So I come from a journalism background, but I also come from a kind of facilitation, conversation facilitation and creative arts background, so I do a lot of things outside of journalism in terms of content creation. I have been in the industry for maybe 3 or 4 years now. I think it's been an incredible journey in terms of opportunities and meeting really lovely people, and it has been challenging and easy at times. So I think the challenges have been more so in the sense of let me put it to you this way. I don't think there's ever been a white journalist that's been the only white person in the room, where I'm often the only black person in the room. And to me, it's not so much just about color, but really kind of cultural background and class and kind of connection to a class that you don't really see in newsrooms. So a lot of the people I'd work with, lovely people, great, well-meaning people, but often kind of come from a similar upper middle class kind of a background, and mainly very white neighborhoods, and have very similar life experiences, went to all the best universities and all that stuff. So they're informed people, but they don't have a kind of lived experience with a lot of everyday Australians. So I kind of entered these situations often. I know how to do my job, but I don't think like everyone around me. I know how to use the rhetoric that exists in, in different bubbles. So I kind of went into the industry thinking the stuff about, race and class and education that my friends and I are kind of aware of. I went into the industry thinking, well, I'm going to be working with all these experienced professionals. They would know all this stuff a lot more than me, because they would be a lot more educated. And I was really surprised to find that a lot of people just had no idea about this stuff, and they didn't really understand racism and discrimination. And you'd kind of mention things and they'll be like, oh, I never thought of it that way. Like, that's never come up. And that really kind of threw me back.
So but it's interesting to hear you say that you would bring up those issues and they would express surprise. Do you think that they took on board your lived experience?
Look, it depends, right? So not every kind of department I've worked in has been the same. Some have been, particularly in the arts, have kind of been a lot more understanding, because, again, a lot of the time with arts, we want cultural diversity because there's a kind of dry up of the same stories, so they need newer stories. In terms of kind of political news, I think what the industry does is that it just kind of listens to itself. So it listens to its trusted fellow journalist who's been writing the same thing for another year, or it kind of goes around in circles. So when someone like me comes in, he's like, oh, there's a whole other take here. There's this whole other voice that we don't really listen to. Kind of response I've gotten in the past is like, well, no, that's just identity politics. Like, it's not, it's who are these people? Why do we care? Why should we listen to them? It's like, well, these are the people that you're writing about. These are the voices that need to be represented.
And where do those conversations end up? I mean, are your ideas then taken up, and the people that you're suggesting be spoken to, or is your experience that, generally speaking, what ends up being shown to an audience is what was originally intended?
I think sometimes it can be on a superficial level. So it's kind of this thing where, like, okay, yeah, well, let's just find a brown person to talk to. Like, let's meet the thing. So, we've got a range, and like we're being, and it's very clinical. It's not like, let's come to understand this whole new perspective that challenges the status quo. Like, let's understand the source of it. And I think sometimes that might be done a bit more, particularly with the public broadcaster, in kind of meeting the expectations of what like the audience puts pressure on. Mm-hmm. So I think the way they approach the kind of impartiality situation is like, okay, well, we'll hear from a Muslim woman, but we'll hear from a racist white man, because we want to have both perspectives. And so the audience then kind of backs one side and detests another side. And so they obviously, respond very like, oh, well, okay, all right, we don't want to upset our audience, like they pay our funds, like we have to go with that. And so it kind of allows the ebb and flow of the quality of journalism to not reflect Australia's actual kind of makeup, but just reflect who's kind of being the loudest and putting the most pressure.
Yeah, who has the biggest, who has the loudest voice, I suppose. And Soshi, what about your experiences? You came to Australia looking for a fresh start. Has that been easy for you in the media?
Well, I worked at The Age for 22 years. So I've been a journalist for 25 years or thereabouts in Australia.
Yeah.
And I've had various different experiences. When I was at The Age, and I mean, I want to give you some real life examples here, because it's very easy to talk in sort of general terms about not being taken seriously or whatever. But I think it's the examples that speak the loudest. When I was in at The Age and I was covering stories, I found it sometimes very difficult to sell stories that had anything to do with that, brown people or black people, okay? So I covered the dodgy colleges stories almost for 2 years. International students were being ripped off by these colleges. It was a huge money-making machine. The federal government was fully aware of what was going on and acted very slowly to put it right. But I struggled to sell my stories for, particularly for the front page. I thought it was a national scandal, but I really struggled to sell my stories for the front page.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know. I sometimes felt that I just wasn't taken seriously, okay? Mm-hmm. And I have sometimes I joke that I've got a couple of things working against me. It's not just that I'm brown. Sometimes I feel like it's being a woman doesn't help, okay? When there was a story, there were a number of stories where dodgy colleges actually closed down. And those the students who were affected there were domestic students, okay? Mm. When those stories happened, they made it to the front page. And I found that really frustrating, okay? That's just one of my experiences that I had. But having said that, when I finally worked in the position of opinion editor, and I did that in an acting role and in a proper role for nearly 10 years, mm-hmm. that was the first time that I felt that I could make a change. And that's because I was in charge of the opinion pages and I could commission the articles that that I thought were important. And I could also bring on columnists who I thought we ought to have. So,
how was that received both internally within the organisation and by audience?
It was received well, okay, to be honest. So I took on Wali Dali. I took on a whole bunch of female journalists, female columnists as well. And I thought that was important. And I'm really happy to say that Wali Dali is still there writing a weekly column. Mm-hmm. I think it was well received by my colleagues and by readers as well. And I think that that's the kind of change you can make when you do put diverse journalists in leadership positions and allow them to make decisions and back the and then the organization backs those decisions, you can really make a difference. And I felt that for the first time that I could really make a difference was when I became opinion editor.
Right. Okay, so let's look more closely at the report. I mean, the general response to it should be said, I suppose, up front, is that it's kind of fallen into two camps. There are those who acknowledge that there is an issue, that there are problems, and then there are those who are pushing back. Both 7 and 9, who are the worst offenders when it comes to diversity, have made statements that, are kind of ducking and weaving around the issue. Soshi, in 2020, is it enough to say, look, we're trying, but people who are culturally and linguistically diverse are not applying for our jobs?
Well, it's interesting that the commercial network, at least one of them that I heard, said that there were insufficient numbers of diverse people applying for those jobs. I think the first thing you have to do is take that comment seriously. I think it's too easily dismissed, okay? And we have to look at, well, is that the case? I think that there are a number of barriers to entry for people from diverse backgrounds, okay? Yeah. Firstly, I think, if I can just quickly run through them, socioeconomic groups, we've got to accept first that a lot of journalists do come from middle-class backgrounds, and a lot of people who are from migrant backgrounds often come from, families where there are significant economic and social challenges, okay? So we need to acknowledge that. Secondly, I think we have to face up to the fact that the media in some areas, like newspapers, for example, the tectonic plates are still shifting. Newspapers are becoming smaller rather than bigger. Some of them are even closing down. And you've got to ask whether, you know, are people still interested in working in industries which appear to be on the decline?
Right.
I think also you have to look at, I'm going to use Asian families as an example here. A lot of Asian parents don't think of journalism as a profession for their kids. They often want them to go into medicine or engineering or become lawyers or whatever. Certainly that's the case with Indian parents, and I think also with Chinese parents. They don't always think of journalism as the first choice for their kids, and we have to bear that in mind. I think also that journalism in many ways is a closed network. I mean, you know, we say, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Well, it's both. When your connections provide you with a pathway into an industry, things can be so much easier. And these connections are simply not well established for people from ethnic backgrounds. And the last point I just want to make is that I have an issue with lazy newsrooms as well. Few newsrooms actively seek out ethnically diverse voices to work in their newsrooms. They dream about it, but they don't actively recruit those people from those backgrounds. They could have quotas if they wanted to, but they don't.
Yeah, I certainly think there are barriers to entry. Bakri, what have you found? Do you recognise that there are barriers? And if so, for somebody like you, what are they?
Yeah, so for me, I think the barriers are not only just so much in getting in, it's once you're in, you kind of have to rein down your voice, the alternative voice, to something that's more palatable to the kind of homogenous culture that exists inside the newsrooms. I think often journalists tell themselves that, like, you know, we don't have, you know, we have a culture of objectivity and accuracy, and that's kind of all. But reality, you bring any group of people together and they create a kind of culture, a group mentality, a way of what's normal, what's taboo, and what's not. And so when you don't have enough of a range of perspectives and experiences, there's not really going to be anything that's kind of challenging that status quo. So for me, I found that to be a barrier. So if you have one Black person in an editorial meeting, if they speak up, there's not three other, you know, Asian or Black people there to be like, yeah, that makes sense, or I see that. It's just kind of like you're the one person and everyone's like, I've never heard of that concept before.
So do you think that's causing people of diverse backgrounds who actually make it into industry to not remain there, to feel as though there's not, that there's not enough in the business for them?
Yeah, I think it makes them feel that they can't be their true selves. They either have to kind of adapt to what is palatable, or just kind of, I'll just be straight with that. A lot of people of color don't really care about any of this stuff, and so they kind of just go with the status quo. And they're the ones that often newsrooms will kind of uphold and be like, yeah, look, we have this kind of one Black journalist, how diverse we are. And it's beside the point. And then the rest of the people in the room kind of all have the same background, so it's not really diversity. It's just one kind of token individual all of the time.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, part of the pushback on the report is the idea that Anglo and European journalists can cover all kinds of stories, even those from outside of their own personal lived experiences. Is that kind of missing the point, that statement, or is it fair enough, Sushi? What do you think?
No, I mean, I think if you have a newsroom that is full of one group of people, you are inevitably you're going to get a sort of homogeneity in viewpoints, and that tends to produce a sort of uncritical consensus, and that's the issue here. It's not just about having more diverse journalists so that you can reflect the community on which we report. I mean, that's important too. But you've just got to be aware that if you don't have those diverse voices, you do end up producing a homogenous viewpoint and this, you know, uncritical consensus. And that is, when that happens, you have done your audience or your readers a disservice, okay? Because when you have lots of, a lot of diversity in newsrooms, the final news product will tell the widest possible range of stories that best meet the audience's need. And that's what helps to build and expand audience or reader trust. And that's really important. So, no, I think vanilla journalism, if I can put it like that, where it's all coming from one point of view, really does the audience a huge disservice.
And do you think that uncritical consensus, which I agree with you, is definitely a thing, Buckery, do you think that is driving some communities away from mainstream media, causing a level of distrust that might be insurmountable, insurmountable full stop, and driving them to media sources that speak to them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a distrust in media kind of across the political spectrum. So be it, often angry men or hurt men who feel kind of constantly attacked by what they perceive to be kind of leftist, feminist media, or garbage on Sky or Fox, they turn to YouTube and they find some YouTuber who's telling them something that's not necessarily accurate, and so they kind of chew that up and buy that up, and they tell themselves, well, I'm a bit more informed, I'm getting the truth, and really it's kind of it's confirmation bias, and they're hearing what they want to hear, and these YouTube makers kind of thrive off that, and so you do have this thing because of that lack of trust. People are going to other sources and being misinformed along the way, which empowers big political agendas, be it from Russia or Trump or whoever's kind of trying to peddle all their propaganda at a time.
Yeah, how critical a problem is this at the moment, do you think, Sushi?
Taking on?
Yes.
Well, I think it's really important, and I think it's not just important to take on those type of people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, but it's important that once they're there, they're retained as well, and that the organisation fosters a workplace culture that sort of makes those people feel that they can be themselves. When I had an incident once where, when I was a reporter, I lent my, the earbuds for the recorder to a colleague who wanted to borrow them. I gave them to him. A few days later, I went back to him and said, can I get my earbuds back? And he opened his drawer, he pulled them out, he sniffed them and said, oh, they smell like curry, they must be yours. And
then you're kidding.
No. Now, to me, that kind of experience is really quite offensive. And that kind of thing cannot happen. It must not happen, I went to other colleagues and I was absolutely gobsmacked. And I said, I really don't know what to do. And in the same newsroom in which that person worked, I found others who said, you must demand a written apology, which I did in the end, and he did apologise. So, I'm just giving you that one example of it's not just that we have to take on people from diverse backgrounds, we've got to make sure that the environment in which they work is inclusive as well.
And of course that comes from the top, doesn't it? Creating those environments is something that bosses are charged with creating. And I think one of the staggering things about this report as well from Media Diversity Australia was that 100% of news directors are Anglo-Saxon and male. In senior leadership roles in the news, Seven has 0% women, 9 is just 14%. So behind the camera, it's worse actually than what we're actually seeing in our living room. So how alarmed do you think we should be, or how concerned do you think we should be about the possibility of new newsroom cultures when those sort of statistics start at the very top?
we should be very concerned, and we need to make a loud noise about it. And I think, you know, I think the ABC has done really well in this area. I mean, they've actually got a diversity and inclusion plan, and they do have, you know, targets that they've set for, you know, I think they want 15% of content maker roles and 15% of executive roles to be filled by culturally and linguistically diverse by 2022, I think, is their current target. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing you want. The BBC has something very similar. And once you put those targets in place, then you've got to measure them, okay? And you've got to see whether you actually reach those targets, and then you've got to report on them as well. And that's the kind of thing we need to encourage those commercial networks to think about. But that's not going to happen until we start making a loud noise about it. And we can't just make a loud noise about it every time someone produces a report and then we all forget about it and move on until the next report comes out.
That's true. Bakri, do you think that quotas help?
I really do think quotas help. And I know that's kind of controversial because people are like, well, everything should be based on merit. But I think merit is a kind of complicated thing and deceiving because we talk about privileges and opportunities. I'll just give a realistic example of a cadetship program that I was a part of. That was a kind of a brand new program that the ABC had introduced, and the aim was to bring in, you know, young media savvy people from kind of a diverse range, and not just culturally diverse but kind of across class. And there's, you know, one kid in there who was, you know, white but also like not from upper middle class. And this, I remember him saying to him, is like, if it wasn't for this opportunity, I'd be flipping burgers right now. And now you know, he's killing it, and like literally all of us in that cadetship program are doing amazing things, because I think fundamentally when you create opportunities that, you know, aren't as organic as like, yeah, you know someone, you get the job, your parents have backed you the whole way, you have more experience. But if you kind of go along the quota route, what happens is you find people that never thought they would have opportunities before, and so as a result they're a lot more driven. Sometimes you have to be more patient with them because, you know, they need a bit more support in some ways, but in other ways they're a lot more driven and a lot more ready, willing to step up and bringing fresh, new, diverse content. And we saw that as a result from us. We've, you know, produced some of the freshest content and really kind of audience expanding content within ABC, which is the purpose of having us there. And I think that is a kind of successful and positive result, and but it's not, you know.
And that was well received, was it?
A lot of the time it was really well received by audiences. I think at times there's sometimes a situation where certain kind of departments where they're broadcasting ABC are kind of worried about losing some of their main audiences. So if you have a story that kind of represents you know, a young brown person, you might not get, you know, your majority middle-aged white women's all listening to it, although that's your base audience, but you're going to get a lot more young people paying attention. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes they kind of weigh up and they're like, well, like, this doesn't get high numbers because it's like, well, because you're trying to get a new audience, you don't have those high numbers of that new audience yet. So you have to be willing to accept that and just keep trying and let the audience expand. But sometimes the ABC and I imagine the commercials are the same, is like, well, no, like, our audience is just, they look like this, and so if we give them something that's completely different to how we usually do, like, they're not going to pay attention to us. And I think they just struggle to accept that, and you're like, sometimes you have to accept that and keep moving forward, because that's how you're going to have audience growth. You can't constantly trying to be appeasing your base audience with every single piece that you do, because if there's no development or growth or
Certainly there's an argument for challenge there. Now, I wonder what the two of you think of that cartoon that The Australian published last week on Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I'll start with you, Sushi, if I might, on this one. What was your take on it? And would a diverse newsroom have published that cartoon? And if so, stood by it the way The Australian has?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, as opinion editor for 10 years, I dealt with a lot of cartoons and cartoonists, and I had to look at what they drew and make a decision about whether I would put it in the paper or not. The first thing to say about that particular cartoon is that I just don't think it was a very good one, okay? Before we even talk about race or anything else, it just wasn't a very good cartoon, okay? That's the first thing. But I think I really struggle with these kinds of things because I think that, you know, people do jump to this, oh, it's racist, okay? I looked at that and I thought, is that racist?
Is it just outrageous or trying to provoke outrage?
Yeah. The thing with the cartoon, and I think where we can see that they were running into trouble was when the editor or whoever it was tried to justify or explain how that cartoon worked. And the response was that, well, those were Biden's words and we're just sort of reflecting Biden's words. Now, the argument is illogical and actually quite stupid because, yes, of course they're Biden's words, but you've got to think of the context in which he used them and the context in which the cartoonist has now used them, okay? It was not an accurate reflection, or it wasn't funny, it wasn't clever, it was just a daft cartoon. I think that, you know, whenever this kind of issue comes up, I always ask myself, would I have run that cartoon? I don't think I probably would have, simply because it's just not a very good cartoon, and it wasn't funny, it wasn't clever, it wasn't witty, it wasn't smart. There's nothing in it that I thought was particularly good.
Bakri, the Australian's defence of the cartoon, that leak was mocking Biden, not Harris. Do you buy that?
I do see their point, because I would almost go as far as to say that I agree. As a black man, don't trust Joe Biden. I don't think his interest is to actually represent black people. I think his interest is to just win as many votes to defeat Trump, which is what politicians do. However, I think the way they did it would have been a lot more tasteful if they had a diversity of people in their room as they're creating these comics. And if I refer to, like, I've made sketch shows myself and worked in comedy rooms. And when we have a writing room of a diverse group of people, when we're discussing a joke, having people there that challenge us always just makes for a longer conversation, but for more kind of, I guess, informed humor. So I think the point that we're trying to make about Joe Biden is not a completely invalid point, but I think they just did it in a very lazy and tasteless way.
Okay. Now, we've touched on this issue a little bit before you brought it up, Sushi, and that is the pathways into media and journalism specifically. And I'd just kind of like to thresh that out a little bit more, if I might. Because if you've graduated from one of the major universities, found an internship at Nine or the ABC, for example, chances are that your particular background is actually middle class, and quite possibly white. Now, that's not a judgment, it's just a fact. How do we open up the media so it's not just more... So it is more open to culturally and linguistically diverse people, and also open to people from all sides of the economic divide. How do we do that? Because it's hard, right?
Yes, it is hard. I think firstly, I think the journalism schools have a responsibility here, where they have to make sure that when they, interview the students who apply to them to do courses, that they have some sort of focus or attention being paid to whether the J schools are filling their classrooms up with, white middle class students. So they need to be aware of that kind of stuff. And the J schools are the ones
So can I just stop you there? So are you suggesting that universities, for example, should put a quota on the number of white middle-class students studying journalism?
Look, I think quotas, as we were saying earlier, quotas are problematic because first thing is that, the argument is, oh, look, it's got to be based on merit. Yes, I agree with that. Of course it does. But if you I'm just talking about quotas, not in universities, but in the workplace at the moment. If you have an insufficiently diverse newsroom, it means that there aren't any brown or black journalists with merit at this stage, all right? And I would say that the lack of quotas is a system that hasn't worked thus far, has it? We don't have quotas at the moment, and look what we've got. I think that journalism schools, before I sort of say hard and fast, yes, there should be quotas, perhaps it would be appropriate to simply say that they need to be attentive to this, okay? And if they aren't at the moment, they should be. I know RMIT certainly is, but those the J schools need to bring in those students. Now, the other thing I do, and I do this outside my normal work, I actually do go to schools, and I've offered up, you know, that you know, when they talk about careers and young people choosing what careers they want to be, they make those decisions when they're in year 9, year 10, or whenever it might be. And I have gone to schools and said, would you like me to come and talk, you know, about the career of journalism? And I use that opportunity to tell students, look, you can be a journalist, you know, if you come from a Chinese background or brown background, Indian background, whatever. That's my personal attempt at putting this thing right. But I think the journalism schools are important. And also, let's not forget, journalism schools are really important when it comes to finding internships for journalists. So
yes, and I was about to get to that point, because I mean, as a journalism educator, I think one of the biggest problems that I see is that people who are from a diverse background and who tend to come from a lower socioeconomic background as well, are finding it very, very difficult to do the internships that are required. If you really want to work as a journalist and get a foot in the door as a young graduate. So the issue of paid versus unpaid internships becomes a very, very live one. Buckley, was that your experience? Do you see the lack of paid internships, paid opportunities to get your foot in the door as one of the major contributing factors for the paucity of people of diverse backgrounds in our newsrooms?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in terms of being able to build experience and kind of get hours under your belt, it's a lot harder if you have to also sustain yourself while studying to then just be working for free. And so some people, you know, have the opportunity to be supported by their parents while they take on an internship. Very fortunately for me, I towards the end of my degree, I was doing a paid internship, and I am really grateful for that, because I don't know where I would have been if it wasn't for that, because that allowed me for the first time in my life to focus on my studies and work in something that developed my career and insight, and also allowed me to sustain myself. Mm-hmm. And when I got to that point, I was like, okay, I really believe I can make it now. But before that, it was a constant kind of sense of uncertainty and definitely don't have that kind of familiar support and backing. And you're constantly hearing how the industry, you know, lacks people that look like you. There's a lot there to deter you.
Okay, look, we're running out of time rapidly, but can I just end on this question to you both? How hopeful are you, and in what time frame would you expect to see some change in the makeup of our newsrooms? Buckley?
I think that's really dependent on how quickly we change the leadership inside newsrooms. Mm-hmm. So I think we're constantly going to have a kind of culturally diverse and gender diverse people graduating and wanting to become journalists. But unless you kind of change up who the editors are and who the kind of chiefs of staffs are, the process of change is going to be really slow. So if we do change the editors, I see things being much better in the next 5 or so years. But if we don't, which I don't think we will, I don't see it becoming much better. It'll probably take decades.
Okay, so you're pretty pessimistic. What about you, Sushi? What do you think?
Look, when I always wanted to be a journalist all my life, never wanted to do anything else. Mm-hmm. I had to first battle my parents who didn't want me to be a journalist. I had to go through an unpaid internship. I had to go through the selection process to get onto a newspaper. And then once I was in, I had to battle the newsroom itself, if you like, okay? I think my feeling is that Australia is a bit of a backwater when it comes to culturally diverse newsrooms. I think other countries, particularly the US and the UK, they do it better than us. But I think we are seeing increasing focus on the issue. And I am really heartened by the ABC's diversity and inclusion plan. Whether other commercial networks will take up something similar is difficult. But I think government You know, if we just had the right noises made at higher levels, that would help. I'm a little bit like Bakri. I think the time frame is it's slow. It's been slow thus far, and there's absolutely no indication that it's going to get any faster anytime soon. So I wish I didn't have to say that, but I'm afraid I don't think that the momentum is not there yet. But hopefully it will be there before my own daughter, if she wants to ever become a journalist. I hope she doesn't have to face some of the things I've had to face.
Yes, indeed. Well, look, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you both very, very much for joining me today. It's been really enlightening. I hope that you're both wrong on that timeline for resolution, but fingers crossed, and I think a lot of hard work, so let's roll our sleeves up and try to get it done. But thank you both very, very much for joining Fourth Estate today.
Thanks.
On that note, I'd like to thank you both, Sushi Das and Bakri Mahmood, for your time today. It was a great discussion. And if you'd like the report, Who Gets to Tell Australian Stories, just go to the Media Diversity Australia website. And thanks for listening to The Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation, so thanks to them for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and, of course, everything in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle there is Fourth Estate AU. Thanks, as always, to my producer, Anthony Dockwell. My name's Monica Attard, and thank you for listening.